protect another entity. I mean, Israel's qualitative military edge, unless the regime is actually an extension of the United States itself. I mean, your thoughts on this?
I think that Israel has outlived its utility for the United States. I think that before, maybe during the Cold War, during the time of the Soviet Union, the Israelis were of use to the U.S. They were a counterweight to the those Arab governments that were siding with the Soviet Union, like Abdel Nasser in Egypt and other countries. But I think that now it's been quite some time that Israel has outlived. It's no longer useful in any way whatsoever for the United States. And I think this doesn't bode well for Israel at all. I think that the main reasons behind American support for Israel in this day of age, in this era, it's more about domestic issues, the strength of the pro-Israeli lobby, Christian evangelicalism, which supports Israel from an ideological perspective. I think these are the main motivations, but strategically speaking, I'm rather skeptical that Israel does the United States any good, particularly now that it's proven itself to be incapable in confronting non-state actors, whether it be Hamas in Gaza or Hezbollah in Lebanon or other players.
Okay, well, Batul, the top military suppliers to Israel is the U.S., Germany, and Italy. The U.S. supplies 69% of Israel's military imports. Your thoughts, so if the U.S. stops arming the regime, I mean, what would happen to the regime?
Absolutely. The Israeli occupation entity cannot last a day without the American security and military support. America is the oxygen through which the Israeli occupation entity breathes through. And I absolutely agree with what the guest has alluded to in terms of the Israeli occupation entity's functional role being, since its onset, to act as a kind of disciplinary stick, as a military stick that can strike any entity in this region of strategic importance that falls outside of the Western empire's interests and dictates. But we've come to a point right now in history, 7.5 decades on, where we see that the Israeli occupation entity is unable to live up to its functional role. Just Gaza, we're talking about 362 square kilometers, and it's unable to defeat the resistance within there and to consolidate its control in the area, which is supposed to be the simplest of all of the fronts. Gaza is supposed to be the weakest link, and it's unable to achieve anything. But this wasn't the case prior, of course. We saw how from 1948, you know, it took literally a few days for the Nakba to be completed in 1967. It then went on and invaded, you know, Egyptian territory, even captured Syrian territory into 1973, where it peaked into Lebanon in 1982. But then that curve started spiraling downwards when the Islamic Resistance of Lebanon was created as a reaction to that, to fight off the occupation. We saw the unilateral withdrawal of Israel from Lebanon for the first time ever, withdrawing from territories that it had occupied. And when it occupies territories, it expects itself to remain there until 2005, where it also unilaterally withdrew from Gaza. So it's not even a matter of like America wanting to impose a ceasefire right now because of the Israeli occupation entity's failures on the ground, but Israel itself at some point will have no choice but to sign the ceasefire paper because of the sheer amount of disintegration and fragmentation and disturbances within the entity itself that's ultimately threatening its survival.
Okay, well, Ali, would you say that then in reality Hezbollah and Hamas are not just fighting the Israeli regime, but the whole Western hegemonic front?
I think that they're certainly disrupting U.S. preferred policies. But I think in the end, it's about Israel itself. That's the major repercussion. I mean, it's a lot more at stake in this region than the U.S., which is hundreds of miles away. But they have disrupted, you know, Western aims. I think that the problem with the American approach towards the region, the American problem in general, is that there are hegemonic policies. Now, should the Americans abstain from trying to practice hegemony or to pursue hegemonic policies, I think it would find no problem in establishing good ties with all countries of the region. And I think more importantly, should the United States halt or drastically change its support for Israel, that could also allow the US to enjoy much better ties with the peoples and with the countries of the region. But Hezbollah and Hamas's capabilities, what they've proven on the battlefield thus far, in addition to the United States, its power gradually reducing, we all know that. They've spoken about not being able, for example, to sustain the same intensity in the flow of weapons to Ukraine and Israel at the same time. There's talk about the United States having to manage its stockpile. It's going to be facing a big challenge from China, which is rebuilding militarily. A lot of people focus on the economic success of China, but I think the military aspect is also something important. So in light of the Israeli incapability, which we saw indeed in dealing decisive blows to Hamas in Gaza, if you add to that the US, its role or its hegemony decreasing somewhat, I think if you factor all those together, the United States won't have much time or the resources it once had to give Israel all this support. And this takes me to the point which was raised by my colleague. If this trend continues, how long will Israel be able to breathe without that very vital oxygen which Washington supplies? Now, I'm not saying that's going to take place in a year or two, but I think it doesn't bode well the way things are going. It doesn't bode very well for the Israelis.
Well, Matu, the Zionist regime initiated terrorist acts and gruesome assassination campaign against Hezbollah and its leadership. The regime leaders thought that the resistance group would be able to cripple Hezbollah, and yet we see Hezbollah is more active than ever with its assault on the regime. I mean, what do you attribute this to?
Absolutely. If we just take a little step back, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon has accumulated power for a very long time now. After 2006, it made great use of the situation. It built its military, political, social power in different arenas to the benefit of the resistance and its people. But despite the power that the resistance has, you know, we saw that it wasn't the initiator or the one that went on the offensive. On October the 8th, it entered as a supporting front into this war to end the genocide, representing that significant pressure card in bringing the war to a halt. This continued for 11 months, and we saw how this supporting front achieved goals that no other resistance could have dreamed of. So instead of the occupation entity trying to create a buffer zone within Lebanon to push the resistance back, the buffer zone is now inside the occupation entity. You have tens of thousands of settlers that are displaced in what is an effective paralyzation in the north. And as you mentioned, that intelligence penetration on the resistance through the pager, the walkie-talkie attacks, the assassinations that were of some tactical benefits to the occupation entity made them in their kind of drunkenness believe that the resistance structure of leadership and control had collapsed once and for all. But in actual fact, we saw that the structure of the resistance is such that it proved that it absorbed and was able to substitute and replace those losses very swiftly. In a few weeks, the leadership command regained its control, and this is also showing through the confrontations on the ground. And we're seeing that the precise hits that require intelligence information and precision to strike. So take, for example, you know, especially the one that strikes to my mind was the hit on the Golani brigades. You know, I instantly thought, you know, this cannot come from a collapsed entity. But it is the requirement of the battlefront that the resistance also does not play all of their cards at once. Given this is a war, this could be long, more brutal. So in actual fact, the Lebanese resistance acts according to an evaluation on the ground. The battlefield is the main factor that determines whether the resistance uses its full abilities or not. But if anyone is surprised by the resistance's ability to regain command and control so quickly, then they don't actually know the resistance. That's the truth. If anyone was surprised by the resistance attacks and their magnitude and precision, especially on Sunday, we saw over 50 attacks, over 400 rockets launched. Likewise, they don't really know the resistance. The leader of the resistance himself used to say, "We have our capabilities. They can reach any point." He is someone who's truthful with his words, according to even his enemies. And the capabilities are all there. The intelligence information for such action is also there. And the resistance has proven that if the enemy's aggressive actions continue, there will be no sense of security within its society. Mm-hmm. The entity that brings insecurity in the region through their attacks should also be prepared to face insecurity themselves when the resistance decides to attack. So they've proved that they have the upper hand in the battlefield.
Well, Aili, just on Sunday, as Batula just alluded to, I mean, Hezbollah fired at least 300 missiles into the occupied territories, including Tel Aviv and Haifa. I mean, Hezbollah's attacks had millions of settlers regularly running to shelter. How is Hezbollah able to evade the U.S.-funded and created three-tier defense mechanisms designed to protect the entity? And all of this has been done with Hezbollah being severely sanctioned, as well as its ally Iran also being severely sanctioned. Your thoughts?
You have to remember that you need to go back to the 80s. Hezbollah is not a new organization, and it's accumulated capabilities gradually. In fact, it was Robert Gates, the former American Defense Secretary, who said that Hezbollah is the strongest non-state military, and it has a military which is stronger than that of many nations. So when you look at an organization of such a size, which has also gained valuable experience, not just against Israel, but also in offensive warfare, for example, in Syria, fighting alongside Iran, even fighting alongside the Russians, I think that it's not a big surprise for Hezbollah to be able to do this. And you mentioned Iran. Hezbollah also has strong backing from Iran. Iran is known when it comes to ballistic missile capabilities, for example. So again, as a follow-up on what my colleague was saying, if you bear in mind the sheer size of Hezbollah, it's not a surprise that it was able to continue to unleash these rockets despite the heavy tactical hits which were dealt to the organization. And I think you have to also bear in mind that one of the reasons why Israel succeeded in inflicting these heavy blows on Hezbollah, like the pagers, like the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, one of the reasons is that the larger an organization is or becomes, the more, you know, the more exposed it becomes, and hence it becomes slightly easier to strike, to inflict these blows. But at the same time, these blows or these strikes won't bring Hezbollah to its knees, given, as I said, that very strong base which has been established, and the fact that it has a very strong state supporter represented by the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Well, Batu, do you think that the Israeli regime has been caught off guard by the preciseness and persistency of Hezbollah?
Absolutely. Essentially, this past year has been an expression of live maneuvering, I think, from both sides, testing each other's capabilities. Despite the lack of advanced aircraft or modern air force for the resistance, it has actually developed drones that are capable of performing precise and difficult missions, you know, compensating for that technological gap. And I think this has everything to do with the necessity of the battlefield, essentially driving that innovation, resulting in the development of tools that are perfectly suited to the resistance's defense. So they've adapted very well. The Israeli occupation entity's claims of, you know, inflicting damage on the resistance has been exposed to be false, because the entity fails to grasp the psychology of the resistance. It only grows, I think, more determined under pressure, its resolve hardening with every loss that it suffers. And also, the entity is quite an exposed state. So Israel operates above the ground. Its facilities are essentially open to devastating strikes. In contrast, the resistance operates as an underground force. Its assets are more difficult to detect. So the impact on the entity's society, on its economy, stability, especially its financial and investment sectors, far outweighs any damage that it can hope to inflict on the resistance's own infrastructure. So, for example, the resistance's ability to target the heart of the entity, critical areas like the capital, Tel Aviv and Gush Dan, you're talking about like the collapse of the state's capabilities when it comes to that. And the Israeli occupation entity is not willing to turn Tel Aviv into Kiryat Shmona. So we have to put it within that context. Each phase of the resistance's strategy unfolds according to a carefully concealed plan. This is, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah promised, you know, you will see, not just hear. And the stage of pain that Sheikh Naim Qasim has also declared is eminent, and we're seeing it before ourselves, and the actions of the battlefield are speaking much louder than the words.
Well, Ali, if we compare the two parties, we see the IOF attacking residential areas, and then there's Hezbollah, which is hitting critical military and intelligence sites and often sensitive areas, as Batul has just pointed out. I mean, which side is more effective and seems to be more astute from a military perspective? And your overall thoughts, why the difference? Why the difference in this?
It's well known, it's a known fact that one of the standard practices of the Israeli military is to target civilians, to target the supportive environment. This is not something which is done just for the sake of doing it. This is something deliberate. Anthony Lowenstein, who was a very well-known scholar and expert on Israel, has spoken about that aspect in Israeli military operations. So the attacks on the Lebanese civilians, like we're seeing now, for example, that aims to put pressure on Hezbollah, particularly that most of these attacks are focused on the supporters of the movement. So that is part, as I said, of a deliberate strategy by the Israelis. Now, on the other hand, Hezbollah, as was mentioned, focuses on military targets, and I think that further increases the legitimacy of Hezbollah in the eyes of the international community. Israel, hence, cannot use the excuse or cannot say that Hezbollah deliberately targets civilians and paint Hezbollah as being, quote-unquote, a terrorist organization. So I think that basically explains the difference between the two players.
Right, right. Well, Batul, on Monday, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said the regime is foolish if it thinks by attacking residential areas or hospitals that it is victorious, because it is not, and that these acts are only increasing the support for the resistance. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. It's very true. I absolutely echo what the other guest has said. There is a kind of vindication for the resistance that happens when the aggression increases. It cements the reality for the people that actually nothing but arms will protect us, because the reality is that this past year has only revealed the true face of the Israeli occupation entity. It's not the case that they were reacting to October the 7th in this unhinged fashion. This is what Israel is. This is what Israel has been for the past 7.5 decades. When you're talking about the Lebanese people, they know their enemy very well. They occupied their land for 18 years. They waged the war in 2006. And it's interesting. It's they kill the leader of the resistance to reduce that aspect of morale. But if you look actually on the ground, you ask the people that have lost their homes, how do you feel about it? Their response would be, after losing the leader, nothing else matters. No matter what else we lose, it pales in comparison to the loss of the leader. So this kind of attachment that the people have with the leadership is something I think the Israeli occupation entity can and will never understand, because it's something that they don't experience. Netanyahu is someone who millions across the Israeli occupation entity come out on the streets protesting. He's someone who, even prior to October the 7th, there were large protests en masse. The fragmentation and the disintegration within the Israeli occupation entity is something that is unparalleled on every strata of society. You have the seculars who are fighting on the battlefield, who actually don't want to fight, who want to effectively resign because they're too afraid, they don't have the courage. And then you have those more religious Haredi Jews that want the seculars to protect them and want to benefit from the state but don't want to fight. I mean, you've got the fragmentation on every single level in society, the lack of feeling of security, just feeling lost, not knowing where the entity is essentially going, no post-war plan. The Israeli occupation entity is in complete tatters, whereas the people of Lebanon, the people of Palestine, they know this is their land, they know what they're fighting for. And they've proven effectively that they are resilient. You know, you see them on the ground. You hear their statements saying, we will not leave. No matter what, this is our land and these are our convictions.
Right. What about that, Ali? I mean, you're in Beirut right now as we speak. Your overall assessment of the people right now, is it that sense of resilience? Is it that sense of we will fight to the end? Or has the regime been effective in trying to intimidate the people and trying to have them pressure Hezbollah into basically stopping the resistance?
I think that the situation in Lebanon in that regard hasn't changed. What I mean by that is that those who supported Hezbollah continue to support Hezbollah and have even increased their support for Hezbollah, and they feel a sense of revenge. They want Hezbollah to inflict heavy blows on Israel, especially given the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who enjoyed immense popularity. Now, for those who don't support or were not supportive of Hezbollah, many of them continue to have a similar stance, still not supporting Hezbollah and seeing this as an opportunity to weaken the movement. Now, that being said, it also has to be emphasized that there's a very big segment which had a different stance, for example, during the war in Syria. And I'm speaking here about some of these Sunni groups like Al-Jama'a Al-Islamiyya. Their stance has changed drastically in support of Hezbollah due to Hezbollah's role in supporting the Palestinians in Gaza. So that Shia-Sunni sectarian issue, which maybe existed before, it has very much diminished as a result of what's taking place right now. For example, many Lebanese Shias have been taken in by Sunni families in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli. The Druze, Walid Jumblat, he's been supportive also of Hezbollah. So these are, I think, are very important changes which show that Israel hasn't succeeded in any way whatsoever in weakening Hezbollah domestically.
Okay, and Batul, I mean, as the IOF continues to suffer from battle fatigue after its 13 months of genocide in Gaza, and Hezbollah continues also with its retaliatory attacks, do you think that that is playing a role in talks about a ceasefire, that in actuality the regime wants a ceasefire right now? I mean, your assessment of that?
Yes. So the paper right now that they are discussing, that's been circulating in the media, is just to stop the current phase of confrontation. Otherwise, the conflict is present and it's ongoing. Just because points are agreed to, it doesn't mean that Netanyahu will agree to effectively sign them. If we look at this whole year, it's been an expression of almost reaching an agreement and then last minute, Netanyahu not signing it. So it is at the draft stage now, and media is talks more than anything. But I do want to emphasize that since yesterday's very strong hits by the resistance, you know, we've been discussing over 350 rockets, the Israeli occupation entity is not prepared to allow Tel Aviv to become dysfunctional and for it to become like Kiryat Shmona or Haifa. There is no objective that supports the Israeli occupation entity in continuing this war. So even if America was to leave Israel on its own, it will eventually have to stop the war. And this is something that the Islamic Resistance of Lebanon also understands well. In the same way that the Israeli occupation entity unilaterally withdrew from Lebanon in 2000, it wasn't under American pressure that they withdrew, because there were no more objectives for them to remain. You know, continuing the war will not support Israel's objective in creating a new Middle East. It's not going to give it any kind of stabilization in controlling any of the villages in the south on the ground. It's been unable to maintain any stable presence. The only outcome of this war for Israel is further disturbance and disintegration within the Israeli occupation entity, so it has no interests to remain. And then also the question of Gaza remains.
All right, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Ali Riz, security and political analyst out of Beirut. Batul Sabeti, activist and political analyst out of London. And thank you for staying with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, was the living, breathing miracle of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. And his eminence, the Messenger of Allah, he very beautifully trained and educated and nurtured and brought up Imam Ali alayhi salam. And it is this nurturing that the Holy Prophet did with Imam Ali alayhi salam that we find His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, becomes the first divinely appointed Imam. And so he's the best apprentice, the best disciple, the best follower, the best reflective image of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, as well as the Holy Quran. There's very interesting things in the life of His Eminence and the way that he lives his life that if we apply in our own lives, we will be able to live a more prosperous and happy life. And so one of the things that we see when it comes to Imam Ali alayhi salam is His Eminence's action. So for example, we find that His Eminence was always in the field of action. His Eminence was always in the field of action. He was always doing something, some good deed, some good action, some good behavior. You know, it's not like we find him at any point in a state of laziness or lethargy or, you know, just like what we say in the present day, a couch potato. In fact, His Eminence was constantly in the state of action. And that state of action is what will be of benefit to us in the hereafter. You know, and Imam Ali alayhi salam, he even talks about these kind of things along with living like that and having this universal persona where an individual does not, you know, necessarily even have to be Muslim to be able to take advantage of these beautiful points that Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks about. So, you know, for example, he lives this quotation of his that a person who is in the state of action and who is constantly doing, that is the individual who achieves the hereafter. That is the person who achieves paradise, or that is the person who achieves success in the next world. You know, it's interesting, but His Eminence kind of talks about the same aspect, but in reverse. He says, you know, don't be like an individual who hopes for having bliss in the next world but does not act, you know. And this is the exact opposite of what the universal persona of Imam Ali teaches us. The universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, teaches us to always be in the state of action, you know. It doesn't mean that we, you know, can't take time to take a break, or we can't take time to, for example, take a vacation. But even if we are taking a break or we're taking a vacation, if it is done for the sake of Allah, if it is done for the sake of the nearness and satisfaction of the Almighty Allah, then even that becomes a state of action and a state of worship. And so always trying to keep ourselves busy with good deeds, with deeds that the Almighty Allah will accept and be satisfied with. A very beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: متى أشفي غيظي إذا غضبت؟ أحين أعجز عن الانتقام فيقال لي لو صبرت؟ أم حين أقدر عليه فيقال لي لو عفوت؟
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, used to say, "If I am angry, when shall I vent my anger? When I am unable to take revenge, and it be said to me, better you endure, or when I have power to take revenge, and it be said to me, better forgive."
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
The word Mawla has the same meaning and implication as Awla, the question that he raised first. And so Ali is also Awla over the Mu'mineen, has more authority over the Mu'mineen than themselves. And so the context is actually very clear about it, and so we don't have to really go into details here and there. But now that I talked about this importance of the name of Ali, Ali means somebody who is high and raised. Let me talk about another name of Ali. One of the elders that I had asked me in Ramadan, actually, and I promised him that I'll talk about it in the Majlis so everybody can know. The other famous name of Ali is Haydar. What does Haydar mean? In history, there is slight different variations in the narration. The name Ali was given to Ali by Hazrat Abu Talib. But then the mother had also given a name. And she gave two names to him. Number one was Asad. Asad is actually the grandfather on mother's side of Ali. And Asad means lion. There is another name also given by the mother to Ali, and that is Haydar. And the word Haydar also means a lion. So Asad and Haydar has exactly the same meaning. And Amir al-Mu'minin used to actually take, you know, pride in this name that his mother had given to him. Especially if you look at the Battle of Khaybar. This is the Jewish, castle or the fortress. Where the people actually who had been, they were part of the city of Medina, and there was an agreement between the Prophet and them that they will basically be part of securing the city whenever there is an attack from outside, but they actually betrayed that trust. And they became the enemies from within. And so they were expelled from Medina. Later on, they conspired with the mushrikeen of Mecca in the Battle of Khandaq. They actually came all the way to Medina to fight the Prophet and the Muslims. So after dealing with the mushrikeen of Mecca, the Prophet decided this time to really pay a visit to these people because they are not letting go their mischief against us. And so, you know, the Muslim army went to Khaybar. Many people were given the command. They went there and came back without any success. It was the month of Rajab. Eventually, the Prophet asked, you know, he said, tomorrow I'm going to give the standard, the alam, to somebody. And this description is very important. You know, our Zakirin only talk about Rajulan Karrar, that I'm going to give the alam to a man. And Karrar, somebody who is steadfast, doesn't move away. But then I think there was a greater description there where the Prophet says, not only Rajulan Karrar, somebody who loves Allah and the Rasul, and whom Allah and the Rasul also love. Where he says, I'm going to give the alam to somebody who is Rajulan Karrar, yuhibbu Allah wa Rasuluhu.
At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma fastajib du'ayi واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with the reporters.
Early on Sunday, Jordanians woke up to a shooting near the Israeli embassy in Amman. According to an official government statement, the shooter exchanged fire with security forces, injuring three officers. He was subsequently killed. Political analysts have linked the incident to the significance of the location, which has been the site of year-long protests involving thousands of Jordanians calling on the Jordanian government to close the Israeli embassy.
What happened this morning is an unacceptable attack in every sense. We oppose it politically, and we assert that the presence of this embassy, if the incident was indeed related to it, does not justify the assault on the public security forces. These officers are our sons, and they represent the decisions made by political forces, the government, and parliament. As the Popular Unity Party, as political figures, and as political parties, we view the public security forces as the Jordanian forces. They must not be challenged or confronted. The international community and global organizations must exert pressure on Israel to halt its genocidal war.
Jordan's leftist parties attributed the incident to escalating tensions over events in Gaza and called for urgent regional and international action to end the war.
I believe that what occurred today in front of the Israeli embassy in Amman cannot be viewed in isolation from the criminal war. Israel is waging against the people in Gaza and Lebanon. This Zionist entity is conducting a campaign of genocide. The emotional, political, and future repercussions of this genocide are felt across all Arab and Muslim nations, as well as by all free people around the world.
It's important to note that the Israeli embassy in Amman has been closed for over a year after the start of Israel's war on Gaza in early October last year. This led to Jordan recalling its ambassador from Israel and not allowing the return of Israel's ambassador, who had previously left the kingdom.
As these developments unfold, calls are growing to bring an end to the genocidal war on Gaza and to ensure regional stability. Jordanians are highlighting the importance of taking decisive action to support the Palestinian cause and work towards a just peace. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
In the Iranian capital, once again, Denova has brought together students eager to learn about technology and innovative ecosystems to utilize the resources available and share knowledge in order to develop their scientific and research skills.
The role of science and technology parks is mainly to help the commercialization of scientific and research activities. An important part of these activities is done by university students, but in recent years, we have organized this ceremony with a different approach to recognize the talents of students.
This groundbreaking event not only fosters global collaboration, but also provides a platform for the next generation of innovators to showcase their skills and contribute to the rapid advancement of transformative technologies.
Our goal of holding this exhibition is to promote innovation and creativity in students.
The purpose of these student visits is to strike a spark in their minds so that in the years to come they will be able to be creative and design a new product through the textbooks that have been taught to them.
The third DeNova Student Technology event focuses on 10 specialized fields of programming and artificial intelligence, electricity and electronics, mechanics and precision instruments, robotics, cybersecurity, health and treatment, chemistry and synthetic materials, soft and creative industries and environments.
This greenhouse has been designed for the first time in the size of home use, and it is the first time that it has been unveiled in Iran. This greenhouse works without using soil and only with air and water.
We decided to prepare a biological mulch and place it on the soil so that it does not produce pollution during wind erosion.
Mulch is actually a cover that sits on the surface of soil and sand and sticks to it tightly, preventing particles from being suspended in the air when the wind blows.
The event serves as a significant milestone with dedicated students working together to cultivate a vibrant and future-oriented technology sector, encouraging innovation and fostering a new generation of inventors in the field.
The goal of hosting this event is to identify and nurture exceptional talents while fostering students' innovative projects and ideas. This initiative aims to empower students to develop their skills, showcase their creative potential, and contribute to the advancement of cutting-edge fields. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Over the past month, Israel has drastically reduced aid deliveries to Gaza, severely limiting access to food and medical assistance for millions of people trapped in the territory and facing a humanitarian crisis. So many are enduring conditions reminiscent of northern Gaza, which is under weeks-long deadly siege and assault, with around half of the population, the Gazan population, being children. The risk of malnutrition and dehydration is high, as they dream of only one vegetable or fruit.
We used to buy chicken, meat, and everything else regularly on Fridays before the war. This Friday, however, we have nothing, not even a single loaf of bread. We spend the entire day waiting in line for bread at bakeries, but we never get any. Even if we find fruits, vegetables, or any other type of food, the prices are extremely expensive. I haven't had anything since this morning. While no one is paying attention, we are experiencing unprecedented famine.
I just want a proper meal, like meat. Today, all we had were some za'atar and a few fava beans. I went to the charity for food, but it was closed. This happens every day. I often end up with nothing on my plate.
In Gaza, children wait in long lines for a single plate of food, which often fails to satisfy their hunger. Their days are filled with either forced work or some boring playtime, providing only a temporary distraction from the ongoing Israeli attacks. Israel has killed over 17,000 children in Gaza, while other children, either injured in Gaza's hospitals or displaced in tented camps, are facing starvation. These children endure unimaginable pain and panic as the famine continues to escalate across the besieged strip. Abubakar Abid, Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
The streets of Sana'a came alive once again as hundreds of thousands of Yemenis poured in to protest against the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The demonstrators were united not only in their condemnation of the Israeli regime, but also in their outrage at the United States' veto of a UN Security Council draft resolution that demanded an immediate and unconditional ceasefire in Gaza. Many Yemenis see this as a blatant betrayal of justice and a green light for further Palestinian suffering.
The American veto is nothing new. They are the architects of the aggression in Gaza, Lebanon, and now the Red Sea. The West has sponsored this Zionist regime since World War II with the goal of occupying Muslim lands.
The Ansar Allah resistance movement revealed during the rally that its fighters had successfully targeted Israel's Nevatim airbase in the southern Negev region.
The missile force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a precise operation targeting the Nevatim military airbase linked to the Israeli enemy using a Palestine 2 hypersonic ballistic missile. The operation successfully achieved all its objectives.
The weekly protests, coupled with Yemen's growing military actions, signal the country's commitment to actively supporting Palestine and Lebanon, both politically and militarily.
The leader of the Ansarullah movement has urged the Muslim world to take action in order to end the Israeli genocide of Palestinians and achieve complete liberation of the Muslim world from Western domination. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
It has been a year since a four-day humanitarian pause was declared in the Gaza Strip. At the time, hopes were high that this could finally bring an end to the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. However, all hopes were dashed after the Israeli regime resumed attacking the besieged territory. Now, 1 year on, there is no end in sight to the onslaught as the Israeli regime passes ahead with its attacks.
The bombings we are hearing are a clear example of the Israeli terror that has not stopped for over a year, and the regime still refuses to end its genocidal campaign. A year ago, we thought that this genocide ended, but all we have is more suffering.
Palestinians say the Israeli regime should heed international calls and stop its aggression in Gaza to allow the displaced families to return to their homes.
We were very pleased with last year's truce announcement. We thought and hoped that it would put an end for this onslaught. But here we are, after an entire year, still waiting for the moment a permanent ceasefire is announced again. We are exhausted and just want to return to our homes in northern Gaza.
Since October last year, the Israeli regime has rejected all ceasefire deals and hampered all efforts to put an end to the war.
Those against?
The U.S. this week vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution that called for a ceasefire in Gaza. The draft resolution aimed for an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire in Gaza, alongside a demand for the release of all Israeli captives held by Hamas. The measure received 14 votes in favor, with the U.S. the sole member to reject it.
1 year ago, Gazans held into fragile hope that the Israeli genocide was finally coming to an end. However, today they are left grappling with uncertainty as they navigate the harsh realities of the current situation. They find themselves asking if they will ever breathe that long-awaited sigh of relief again. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
Thousands of Jordanians took part in a massive rally in Amman after Friday prayers, protesting Israel's recent statements about displacing Palestinians from the occupied West Bank. They condemned the remarks as part of the Zionist agenda to undermine the Palestinians' right to statehood.
The annexation of the West Bank is no longer a matter of isolated statements from extremists. It has become a central agenda of the Israeli regime. The U.S. administration clearly refuses to recognize that the West Bank is under occupation and the plans to displace Palestinians and annex the territory amounts to declaration of war on Jordan. The so-called two-state solution and peace settlement are now effectively dead. Incoming U.S. President Donald Trump has explicitly stated that Israel is small and needs to be expanded. We reaffirm our unity in opposing the Zionist agenda and rejecting these dangerous schemes.
Participants in the rally organized by the Islamic movement in Jordan under the slogan Annexation of the West Bank, a declaration of war on Jordan, warned against the potential evacuation of certain areas in the occupied territories, similar to the situation in Gaza. They also raised concerns about Israeli threats to Jordan, stressing the need to strengthen the internal front in response to these challenges.
In this march, we reaffirm our rejection of the far-right Israeli cabinet's plans, including the annexation of the occupied West Bank and the Judaization of Al-Quds. It is imperative that all ties with this Israeli entity be severed, and our internal front must be strengthened to prepare for confronting this aggression and the regime's expansionist ambitions.
We are here to deliver several messages, including one to the international community. Israel's decision to annex the West Bank is, politically, a declaration of war on Jordan and an attempt to reshape the West Asia by displacing Palestinians in the West Bank and dissolving the Palestinian Authority. We must confront this looming threat and firmly state that we will not allow such actions.
Participants condemned the statements of certain Israeli officials and denounced their racist, inflammatory, and extremist comments that advocate for Israeli sovereignty over the occupied West Bank and the expansion of settlements. Jordanians continue to protest against Israel's atrocities, condemning the ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza and severe violations of the Wadi Araba Treaty. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
Yours truly, as a soldier commissioned by yourself in this mission, upon completing the operation to liberate Abu Kamal, the last stronghold of Daesh, and lowering the flag of this American Zionist group and raising the flag of Syria, I announce the end of the rule of this accursed evil tree.
That was part of Commander Qasem Soleimani's letter to the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, announcing the success of his forces in defeating Daesh terrorist group and freeing their last stronghold. And today, the anniversary of this success has been named National Heroes Day in the country in the loving memory of this commander, who was in the end assassinated by the U.S.
This is the nature of imperialism. Whoever stands in the way of their interests, they'll either try to buy him off or they'll assassinate him. Martyr Soleimani wouldn't be bought off with money. He wouldn't stray from his path with the promise of material gain. So, they decided to assassinate him.
The Daesh terrorist group, which was initially created by the U.S., attracted more terrorists in the region and mobilized them against countries that resisted the Israeli occupation.
Commander Soleimani successfully dealt a significant blow to the Western Front, particularly the U.S., as evidenced by numerous leaked documents from their own officials. For instance, during a presidential debate, Trump mentioned the role that Clinton played in creating ISIS.
She gave us ISIS as sure as you are sitting there. And what happened is now ISIS is in 32 countries, and now I listen how she's going to get rid of ISIS. She's going to get rid of nobody.
But American crimes went beyond the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Mohammad Reza Zahedi, another commander who had brought about the defeat of Daesh terrorists, was later assassinated by Israelis in line with the same policy, a crime followed by yet another assassination, that of Commander Abbas Nilforushan.
The Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation demonstrated unwavering resilience in their fight against the terrorist-natured war targeting the Muslim world. This conflict was part of a larger U.S. strategy, in conjunction with its key ally Israel, aimed at achieving their respective goals in West Asia. Israel seeks to secure its existential interests, while the U.S. aims to regain power and influence in the region. Given this context, maintaining vigilance is crucial.
For years, Iranians have raised their children ready to fight back. Their culture of resistance is evident in the many traditions and events held to revive the memories of the heroes of resistance on occasions such as National Heroes Day. According to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, such memoirs are more than personal stories. They are our national heritage. Preserving them helps empower our nation to overcome challenges. Therefore, as heroes battle and fall, Iranians are determined to keep their memories alive. Mariam Azarchar, Tehran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the believer's trials and tribulations. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab. So this is a very big topic, But the believer's trials and tribulations are things that we probably all talk about on a daily basis as believers. We're probably maybe sort of comparing notes with, let's say, with one of our friends. Maybe they're going through a particular hardship in their family. They've had some bad news. Maybe one of their kids has been taken to hospital, and maybe... And maybe just the day before that, a few days before that, it was sort of the other way around. The friend was maybe listening to us because maybe we had issues and trials that we were going through. And so obviously when we talk about this, a lot of it is, it's not just that we understand how it works, what these tests, trials and tribulations are for. When we share this knowledge and compare notes with what's happening within each other's lives, we also, obviously, we increase our connection with those people.